The method.
Ideas. Method became
unsound.
Are my methods unsound?
Without doubt. Do you call it unsound method?
I don't see any method at all.
Hello and welcome to Unsound Methods with me, Jamie Batchin.
And me, Lachlan Bloom.
If this is your first time listening, it's a podcast where we speak to other writers of literary fiction about their craft, approach and technique.
And this month, we're speaking to Christopher Priest. We spoke to Christopher back in November last year in 2023 and had a great conversation with him. As sadly, since then, Christopher passed away in early February this year. But we were lucky enough to get in depth about his process and how he goes about writing before then.
Yeah, I think it was great to sort of speak to him. He was obviously in quite a reflective mood, I think, as you'll hear from this conversation. And talked a lot about how he got into reading and writing and the writers that were really important to him and shaped him, and that he spent his life going back to a lot of the writers that we're interested in and that we love as well. We covered some of the things that he shuns that we speak to a lot of writers who completely believe in, such as using notepads, which he felt was a crutch.
He came across as quite a sort of rebel spirit in a way, which is, I was kind of surprised in a way, because reading his books, he seemed very tightly sort of structured and quite sort of not formal, but very carefully plotted out. That was the impression I'd got, but he seemed to say the opposite. He doesn't really believe in notebooks or plotting things out. And yeah, he seemed to take quite an anarchic approach to a lot of things, I felt.
But I mean, by his own admission, he did benefit from a photographic memory, which I think is always going to help with a lot of these things. Apart from erroneously adding a spire to Lincoln Cathedral, which, as you'll hear, he had a lot of feedback about.
This sort of issue, I think, most of us would find it quite minor. And certainly in terms of when I come to plotting things, the holes are slightly larger than an erroneous spire on a cathedral.
Well, I hope this is a fitting tribute to the writer and his work. Here is Christopher Priest.
One question we often start with is when you first approached writing as a serious pastime or pursuit, when writing fiction seemed something that you could build a career out of.
I discovered literature quite late. I think I was about 16, 17, and I suddenly realized books were written. They weren't made by publishers, that the human beings actually took and composed them and, you know, put quotation marks and underlines, I think. It was absolutely enlightening to me. And my life at that point was a typical teenage fuck-up. Kind of, you know, this horrible, unpleasant, surly teenager. And I suddenly thought, I don't want to do this. I want to be a writer. And it changed just like that.
Was there a particular book or a particular...
There was one particular book. It was a book by Brian Aldiss, As It Happens. I suppose it could have happened to anyone. And from that instant, I made a resolution. I'm going to stop fucking up. I don't know anything about writing. I'd be in no background. I don't come from a literary heritage. My parents aren't writers. Nobody in the family is a writer. I thought, I'm just going to learn how to do it. And from that moment, within a couple of years, I sold a story. And within 5 years, I was a freelance writer. Well, no, that's a bit of a lie. It was longer than that. When I was 25, I became a freelance writer, and I've done it ever since. And I've never, ever resiled from that teenage resolve. Never do less than the best. Just do it and don't fuck up. And it's a sort of simple thing. It's got me through 55 years.
You make it sound very simple when it's been like that.
The thing is, I've worked hard. I really earned it. And I didn't know shit about writing. I actually published a book, which you probably haven't seen, which is called As That's Mine. And I self-published it because nobody else in their right mind would publish it. But it's advertised on Amazon. But it's the first 10 short stories I wrote, including the very first, which is awful. But it's very interesting that over the next 5 years, it's definitely get better. Until at the end of the five-year period, the last story is just about not publishable. But that was the last thing I wrote before I became a full-time writer.
I mean, that's an interesting document to then look at. But I mean, is that literally the first short story that you wrote once you made that resolution? Right. That's
it's because I finished. And if I dated exactly, I was writing it on the night that John F. Kennedy was shot.
Right.
I remember I was all writing it, and the news came in, and, you know, like everyone else, you remember exactly what was happening. So that was 63. And by 68, I went freelance in August 1968.
And how did you approach that period? Were you looking for doing any kind of courses or speaking to any other writers about it? Or was it a purely sort of internal process of...
Well, of course, after reading, the great mentors of the fairly unoriginal, like, you know, George Orwell, and I like Graham Greene, I like Scott Fitzgerald, didn't like him much, but I like John Fowles, thought John Fowles was something special. I like Muriel Spark, because I thought she had a bad attitude, and I've always had a bad attitude.
And did you consciously change your reading then at that point, once you decided that you wanted to write?
I always read Catholic. Uh-huh. I just pick up books. But the ones that matter are the ones that you respond to and you sort of, I mean, with Orwell, I just felt it was like drinking spring water. It's fantastic. And I still read Orwell to clean out, you know, after reading some shitty crap, you just read some George Orwell essays and, you know, you remember what you can do with English.
Mm. And in that period, were you sort of consciously trying to copy aspects of the writing that you admired? Or how did you go from not being published to being published over that period? Did you write sort of hundreds of stories that...
No, I wrote 10 or whatever it was of that book. See, I see influence in terms of opportunity or demonstration of, you know, I didn't know you could do that. And, you know, you're reading something and you suddenly realise they've done something. I learned a lot from Kingsley Amis about plotting. Kingsley Amis is not recognised for his plotting. It's really good. And if you actually study the study, my God, that's a good way of doing it. But you don't, well, I don't want to be Kingsley Amis or even write like him.
When you were reading, were you taking notes? Were you reading sort of as a writer, whatever that might mean? Or were you just sort of absorbing things that you liked, just following the lead of the writing that inspired you? But were you taking notes at the same time? Or
it's a bit of both. I remember when I started this urge to be a writer, all of a sudden I was much more critical of the books I was reading, because I think, oh, that's the way I would have done it. No good. And, you know, learn by negatives. I'm very interested in craft. Craft is something I write about, and it's something that really matters to me, because I think craft is, in the literary world, craft is rather taken for granted. But I think it's a form of art, and in art there's always inspiration, but there's also hard graft. It's work.
Did you feel that you'd kind of, I mean, obviously everyone is always improving, or you always want to improve, but by the time you went freelance and were published, did you feel you'd sort of hit on your approach in a way? And that previous period was a case of learning what worked for you, and from then on you were just refining your craft, or there was no distinction before and after that point? It's just a continuum.
All I can say, I've never stopped learning. I'm very self-critical, and I look at my old books, I think, could do better. I'll try to improve all the time. And I always say that every time I start a new novel, I have to learn how to write all over again. Otherwise, you just regurgitate. It's a mess of total, I mean, my life has been totally subsumed by wanting to write and writing and doing the stuff. I mean, it's not a great claim. It's a kind of obsessive nonsense.
Well, I think it's something we've sort of talked about before in terms of the less attractive side, maybe being a writer, in terms of the selfishness, for want of a better word, but it's not inaccurate, that it takes, and that kind of the kind of determination, the blinkered determination to kind of do what you need to do to get on with it, and not entirely being present all the time because of that.
Yes. I'm very interested at the moment about J.G. Ballard. I'm writing a biography of Ballard, And his long-term partner said memorably somewhere that they would sit around in the evening and he'd be watching TV and he'd be watching sort of the Rock the Files or something stupid like that. And she said, that was Jim. And then suddenly he'd go very quiet and I realised I was sitting in the room with JG.
I mean, I think that's quite a common thing. You hear that with sort of sportsmen or sports people as well. Yeah, they have, especially if they have a sort of nickname attached to them. Yeah, they have those two different assets that are, one is usually easier to get along with than the other.
Yes. I mean, the thing is, it sounds unhealthy, but I think writers should marry each other. You know, even if you don't work well together, at least you understand why somebody's walking around the room kicking the animal.
Thinking on that, I guess, do you find there's a sort of rhythm or cadence with, like, I think of like when you start a new novel, is there a particular sort of feeling or moment that you go, okay, now I'm going into this headspace and I'm not going to be able to sit and watch TV in the same way? Or is it sort of more constant underlying, you know, every day you're writing and one day no more than the next? Or do you find, you know, a new novel kind of comes upon you and then you're swept away?
Once you get them right, they sort of write themselves. You know, you get, I mean, all writers call it the voice. You switch on, you see the voice, but it's not always the same voice. You have to, depends on book to book. And the hardest thing is to start a new one, having just finished an old one, because at that point, you've solved how to do it. You think, oh, good, I'll do that. And so you end up doing the same thing. And so what you have to wait to do is wait for something to change so that you approach it at least some slightly different.
And what would be your sort of first steps as a sort of embryo of an idea? Would you be sort of reaching for a notebook and...
I never use a notebook.
Not at all.
Don't believe in it. I do it from imagination only.
So if you have an idea, you wouldn't note it down at all. Would you try and remember it?
I'd look down for details. If factual details, where Oxford Street is in relation to Tottenham Court Road or something like that. But not serious notes. I think notebooks are a trap.
How long would you sort of let an idea gestate then before, I say, you have an inkling of, oh, this could be something interesting? Would you sort of go for long walks and let it sit for a month or two before putting pen to paper, or would you be, you know, that afternoon?
I don't see any rules. I mean, sometimes it takes 20 years. I mean, for instance, I was in Hungerford on the day of the massacre. I happened to be there, and I thought, there's a book in this, but it took me 15 years to write it. Because you've got to let it become sedimentary, you know, so that it filters, it goes through your own filter bed.
And in all that time, you didn't take, for me, I don't know, it seems a very brave move to not note anything down, because I have an initial idea of something and think, okay, I'll sit on that. But then as other connections and sort of came along, my instinct would be to note it down somewhere to avoid it disappearing into the ether again. And yeah, especially over 15 years, it's a long period.
I have an eidetic memory, one of the most useful things.
Yeah.
So it's, you see, like with Hungerford, there's masses of information about what happened. You don't have to find out what gun he was carrying and the names of the victims of which road he was in, all that. You look that up, it's of no interest. But the feeling you had, the instinct to write, doesn't change. That's yours.
The urge to note things down, it feels brave. It's maybe just my memory is not accurate as yours. I know that if I didn't note certain things down, it would maybe not disappear forever, but it wouldn't necessarily be there when I needed it. Having that to hand is, if you can store it all in your memory, it's better than on paper.
Well, one of the books I found most revealing was the autobiography written by Graham Greene. It's called The Source of Life. It's not very well known, but it's, I think it's Silly Penguin, but it's the only book I've ever read which actually tells the truth about how you write a book. And he says that it's the job of a novelist to forget. And he then explains that he calls it the compost of the imagination. What a writer forgets, it's the compost of the imagination. Very memorable term. And he says, you're writing, and all of a sudden, from nowhere, a memory comes, which is absolutely appropriate to what you're writing. And it's not an anecdote, it's an image, or it's a phrase, or it's a character insight, or something like that. And it presents itself. It's always been there in your memory. I'm always recommending this book. It's now probably looks a bit old-fashioned, but
it's the same concept. It's the same. It doesn't really change in that sense, I think.
Yeah.
I've not read that, but I'll look it out. I think that's true, that when the memory that comes to you at the moment is the right thing for you to write at the time, because it's, as a writer, you're the one creating this, so it has to be what is coming naturally.
You've got to read this or experience it and then forget it. You see, he always says that people ask, Green says that people say, oh, well, you must have just done this, you know, it's so realistic. And he says that there's no room for anecdotes in it. Sometimes it can be a setting or a place name or something like that, or a character name. But in general, if you depend on your memory, if you try to think, you know, sort of note that down, get the notebook out, copy it out, you will immediately become second-rate writer. I feel very strongly about this. I feel the book should be imagined and written from on the hoof.
Yeah, I think that's, from my writing, in terms of when you're saying there of getting your notebook and copying something out, I can't imagine doing that. I would more reach for a notebook in the moment to write it down to stop it somehow slipping from my memory, but I would very rarely look back at the notes somehow. It's bizarre because it's obviously not then acting as an aid in the moment of writing. It's doing something else. But I know we've spoken to other authors that very much do that. And
I'm going against the consensus, because everyone imagines writers go around taking notes of conversations they've overheard and buses and things like that. And nothing could interest me less.
I think it's good, though, given that the podcast is called Unsound Methods, that we keep uncovering people doing it in different ways.
So I guess not having any notes or anything, at some point there comes a stage when you put pen to paper. Is there a sort of tipping point that would sort of send you to your desk to start writing? Or, I mean, I guess it varies from novel to novel, but...
The pill.
Very motivating.
I do this for the money. Not very much.
So that means that you do this sense of having kind of writer's block, or having to fish around for inspiration from the sort of astral plane. This doesn't, you finish one book and then sit down and just start the next one, because...
Oh God, no, I can't. I went 9 years between novels at one point. 9 years without writing. Terrible. Yeah.
And was that because just you weren't grabbing hold of something that was the idea to develop? Or
I had a Dominic Cummings of an editor who totally fucked me up. And I was completely demoralized. And I had to screw around. And during that period, the film with The Prestige came into being. And that became a wonderful distraction, because everything, you know, it was exciting and I didn't have to do anything. And you know, I nodded through 9 years of not writing. And then my present wife, basically said, it's time to get back to it. So I did.
So, yeah, when you are sort of backed it with, well, that's obviously quite a long period of 9 years, but after you've finished any novel, I guess there's a period where you're not writing the very next day. But what drives you to put pen to paper or what do you start with at that point? Do you have a rough idea of the plot and you're starting chapter one, word one, sentence one?
Well, the book I'm talking about is a novel of mine called The Separation, and I worked on it for 2.5 years, and it was a novel about the Second World War, about which I knew nothing, and so I had to research it, and I did research it, and the book took ages. And while I was writing it, I started thinking, after 2.5 years, A, I've got to sell this one, and B, I can't sit around for, you know, 8 months thinking of the next one. So I started planning another novel while I was finishing The Separation. And that I saw as a novella. I thought I'd do something about 20,000 words as a kind of, almost like a isotonic exercise. And I actually started it as soon as I finished this thing. But then I ran into this Dominic Cummings figure who completely screwed my career up.
I don't know if you're able to want to speak about it, how that process, how things went wrong or what happened in that relationship with the editor.
Well, my existing editor with the publisher left. His boss was fired. They did a complete restructure of the publisher. By the time they'd done this, nobody I had ever worked with was still at the publisher. And they brought in new people. And one of the people they brought in was a young, ambitious, very arrogant editor who had a very fixed idea about what a novel should be and tried to make me change my novel into what he wanted to be. And so I was involved in a completely unpleasant pitch battle with this goon. And I'm glad to say that in the end, I didn't change it. I mean, it was published eventually as I wrote it, but I had to fight for it. It wasted a year of my life. And afterwards, I just thought, well, it's not worth the game. You know, I was really depressed.
I mean, that's crazy. You obviously weren't starting out at that point. It's not, you're established, well established as a writer. To have to go through that. I mean, you shouldn't have to go through that at all as a writer, I don't think.
No. Well, he's gone now, so it doesn't matter. You outlive these people. Yeah, I'm still here in years.
It seems, I'm not sure there's any karmic accounting going on, but quite often the arseholes get their comeuppance. That seems too neat.
Well, often the arseholes win.
In the medium term, I like to think that often it comes back for them, but...
Yeah, I mean, the real Dominic Cummings is still, unfortunately, buzzing around.
Yeah. It's very useful to... You can sort of not use four-letter words, just say Dominic Cummings, everyone knows what you're talking about.
Grossly offensive.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we do like to talk a bit about the technical side of things. So when you sit down to start a new idea, I mean, even in terms of whether you write free longhand or whether you use a computer, what's your sort of preferred way to kick the ball off?
Just start a new document, get going. Chapter one, two pages, and then now what I do. Seriously.
The next day when you go back to what you wrote, say this is the second day of writing, is that second day working largely on polishing what you've originally written before you can move on, or are you doing a sort of first draft that you can just get through and get the shape of?
Well, I mentioned the separation. I did 12 separate chapter one. I drafted chapter one, no good, do another one. Over a period of several weeks, I did 12 openings, and in the end, I went back to the original one. That's the one I used. Very strange.
Are those chapter ones, were you sort of jumping in at the same point and looking for the voice, or were you starting from radically different perspectives or points in the sort of universe of the novel?
Yeah. Well, I'm a narrative writer. I plot and story, very important to me. And I'm always hesitant to say this, but I think a story has to be told. So many books are quite well written, but they're very badly told. And I like to tell a story. And so the beginning is important because you're going to live with that for another 100,000 words. You know, and you can say, oh, well, I'll go back and change it. But it never looks right if you do.
So when you're writing these 12 different versions, they're quite radically different, potentially, in terms of the characters, what the sort of opening scene is, what is happening in those chapters.
Yeah, they're just different attempts to get into the story. I mean, it's now, 20-odd years ago. So it seems like a long time ago. But the same was true with The Prestige, which you realise is probably our most successful novel. And that was an absolute bitch to start. I gave it a starting, and that was okay. But then I changed, going back and changed it. And again, after several weeks, I went back to the original version.
And so once you've got the version that you're kind of ready to leap or move on from, are you then sort of redrafting chapter two in a similar way and, you know, working on versions of chapter two and chapter three in a similar way? Or does, once you've got chapter one and the opening set, is it just sort of a straight path to the end of the first draft of the novel as a whole?
Don't think in chapters.
Well, maybe not chapters, but in terms of the next chunk then, however.
The thing about The Prestige is it's two novels in one, and they're told alternately. You hear one, and you accept that as the true version. And then halfway through the book, the story starts again. And I think you start seeing the same incident from another point of view. And the irony that exists is what the reader brings to it, what they remember from the first version. So there's no rules about writing a book. This was a complete radical, for me, a radical change to doing a sort of double-level narrative. And then when I did a second draft, I put in a third level of narrative. So it became extremely complicated. And the film dropped all my complications and just got down to the interesting stuff.
Presumably you had, when you started writing the novel, did you have some inkling that you were going in that direction of...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll do this one first and I'll turn it round.
Yeah, I think that's... I've not read The Prestige, but the novels I have read, that seems very... At the fore of all your writing, that this is a sort of seed of doubt in what you're reading as a reader, of what's coming. Maybe that's having read different books. I kind of approaching it like that, but that obviously requires quite a lot of careful plotting to be able to make that work well, to take a story then show another perspective on it later on.
No, I think like that. I don't contrive it.
So you don't ever, like, you wouldn't get to through a draft and then think, oh, wait a minute, that's not going to work because earlier on I said this, I'm going to have to go back and change what happened earlier. It kind of naturally works out the way it works out from having thought about it.
I know you're saying you're interested in craft. I mean, I always do a complete first draft beginning to end, and then I do a second draft where I retype the whole thing from scratch. Using a printout of the first draft as the source. And that is, so for me, is a way of making a book narratively complete, because all the time you're writing, you're obviously going to improve what you did, because you kind of, you're now more familiar with the voice and the characters. But in addition to that, you know what the plot's going to do ahead, so you can prepare the ground in cunning ways. And the reader will think I know this is true, that the reader respond to this revelation, which they think has come out of the blue. In actual fact, it's been carefully prepared, because through the second draft, I knew I was going to do it, and I worked towards it. I'm not very good at talking about myself, but there's a novel of mine called The Affirmation, which has a major twist about three quarters of the way through. And everyone would guess that far. They would say they never saw it coming. In fact, I was ready for it.
Yeah, I really like that novel. It's,
The funny thing is, if you do that sort of thing, that you confound the reviewers, because I wrote an essay about this, because half the people who reviewed The Affirmation hadn't read it. I knew that because they hadn't got to that bit, and that you can't avoid. It sort of changes everything you know about the book. You look on my website, search around, you'll see I name names of who the buggers were who didn't bother reading the book, yet who reviewed it in The Observer, you know? Very interesting.
It's interesting with The Affirmation, because I know that, and we don't often talk about critics or, you know, the newspaper critics, for example, of books in this podcast. But it does seem that that underwent quite a critical reassessment, perhaps from initial reviews of people not reading it beyond first third or something. So that it's interesting that...
Yes, I had at least four major reviews in major newspapers where they said, oh, this is yet another young writer discovering himself, sitting there writing a book, and, you know, we all know what's going to happen, blah, 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 and that was that. And I said, that's page 18. You didn't wait for page 90. What happened then? And I knew what was going to happen. And then, there's, as I say, the affirmation certainly has a major reversal of interest toward about two-thirds of the way through. And it's, that's the way the story's told. It wasn't there to trick critics. I'm allowed to get critics. But if they don't do their job... I mean, one of the things that's really interesting was about 10 years ago, a fan wrote to me and sent me a copy of the affirmation which he had bought secondhand and asked me to sign it. Okay. So I opened it. And the first thing that fell out was a compliment slip for reviewers. And on the back, somebody had written in handwriting what they thought of my book. And it was terrible. I didn't know who it was, but the essay I wrote is sort of trying to forensically work out who are these awful reviewers it might have been. I think I know who it was, but it's only a guess. But I name names. You know, I think there's an absolute duty in the reviewer that if they can't be bothered finishing it, they should either not review it or say they couldn't finish it. But they should not pretend to have finished it. Ever.
With something like the affirmation, I guess when you started writing it, you had more or less an idea of the plot twists and the shape of it. Is that, would you say that's kind of, in terms of your other novels, you generally sort of go into the writing of it with a clear idea of the outline of the plot?
Yeah, before? It's I compare it with walking from London to Doncaster. If I had to walk from London to Doncaster, I wouldn't know how the hell to do it. But what I would do is set out and get to St Albans. And then having stayed the night in St Albans, I think, now where I'm doing, I'd head for Watford or something. You know, eventually, through a meandering, wandering course, get to Doncaster. And that's really how I do the first draft. I'd sort of get to the next point I could see and then move to the next one, and meanwhile, the aim remains the same. I still want to get to Doncaster.
And I guess, do you have some sort of sense of the, you don't know the exact route, but you've got some sense of the land ahead of, oh, there's a mountain range halfway there? Or...
I'm not going that way. Yes, that's exactly right. And, you know, you sort of, that way, you have all the pleasure of invention, because you're constantly making things up about scenes and characters and events and things like that, to create physical description. You that's the pleasure. But meanwhile, the narrative remains intact over the lead.
And going back to your sort of second draft, you said you write the first draft and then print it all out and then start again writing the second draft. Do you sort of read it out loud at that point at all when you've printed out the pages? Do you read it aloud at all?
I sometimes read bits out, but I would never read the whole thing. But
what would draw you to read a particular section out loud? Yeah, why would you decide to read one section and not another?
Well, I don't often do it. I think I should.
It's a language. It's something we've spoken to a lot of writers, and yeah, some people do, some people don't. But some people they say I couldn't possibly write anything without reading it out loud. I have to read. Sometimes I reread one paragraph 10 times, and I don't do that, but I feel like I should do when I hear that. But
whenever I have read something out, which isn't very often, but whenever I have, I notice all sorts of things like repetition of words, which you don't normally see. So it's a useful technique, but it's not what I'm comfy with.
I mean, we've met some writers who insist that they almost have to do it for everything, but I think if you start out with that not being your method for doing it, it's quite difficult, even if you feel there's some benefit to doing it. Maybe it helps unknot a certain problem, but I think for that to be your primary mode of writing, it becomes very difficult to switch into that, I would think, unless you saw massive, massive unquestionable benefits.
As I say, I think it's a useful technique, and perhaps it's one I ought to use more than I do, but I have this endless problem. If anyone reads to me, I invariably fall asleep. So I always think, I'm not going to read to you.
I know a lot of people are into audiobooks. I find I can't, it's hard to, I don't fall asleep, but I find it hard to latch on to the story in the same way as I can with the words on the page. So moving on from the second draft, would you generally be kind of near the end by the point you've typed up and written it, the second draft, or do you have draft 19, draft 20, and so on?
Obviously, the first draft is a sort of rough approximation of what I intended. The second draft gets into shape. You get the structure and the voice right, you get the characters filled out, and the story starts working. And then at that point, I've got a printed manuscript. Again, I print it out. I go through it by hand and start correcting piecemeal. And then, if necessary, I reset that to send it into the publisher. Mm. The second draft is the key thing for me. I propagate this idea. I think that computers have brought in really bad writing habits. I mean, books are now much longer than they used to be. If you buy a novel published in the 50s, it's usually a small crowd size with 160 pages, you know, 45,000 words. And now you buy a novel, it's sort of 600 pages. You can't open the thing without it breaking the spine. And it's endless regurgitation of terrible things you don't want to read. It's all to do with the people just sit there typing away on their word processors.
It's a weird thing in terms of the commerce side, the unpleasant commerce side of publishing as well, though. I've, on this podcast, many times championed the shorter novel. Like, it's got to be a good reason that a novel's over 300 pages, let's say. But you would think that the bean counters would always think, well, it's going to be more expensive. But maybe they feel that people feel there's value for money, or if people are buying a 140-page novel and it costs them $10.99, that's not going to seem like value for money when compared to something that's a doorstop. I don't know.
The difference now is that the publishers get their typesetting free of charge. They just use the author's text. And in the old days, up to about 1980 or 85, nobody sent in a file. They sent in this paper manuscript, and it had to be typeset by hand, by a typographer. And that was the expensive thing. That's what caught. And if you look at the price of books from about 1990 until about 10 years ago, the price of books didn't change. I mean, the books sold at around $15.99 or $16.99 for years. When the Prestige came out in more than 20 years ago, and it cost $16.99. And books were selling for $16.99 until about a year ago. Now they're £21, you know, because of the cost of living at the moment. They've gone up and it took it. And the reason they stayed low was because it didn't cost anything to typeset. Mm. I mean, it didn't cost more for the paper than the binding. But I mean, we mentioned the affirmation. Now, the affirmation, when I wrote it, it was around 90,000 words, I think, maybe a bit, 88,000, something like that. And I sent it into Faber, great literary publisher. You know, published T.S. Eliot and Beckett and William Golding. And they wrote to me, they said, well, terribly sorry, but we're going to have to ask you to cut it. Could you cut about a quarter out of it? We called the thought to print it. And this is Faber, you know?
And that's a 90,000-word novel as well. That's not, you know.
Yeah. And, you know, and I thought, that's taking 20,000 words out. That's one word in five. Yeah, it goes through everything. So basically, I had this sort of one of these moments where you decide it's some forking road. So I said, no, I'm not going to change it. At that point, because it was Faber, they said, oh, of course, completely understand. We won't mention this again. Yeah, and they didn't, so they published it as I'd written it. But they had a go. And that was all to do with weight. Now, the thing is now, the publishers won't take a manuscript unless it's at least 70,000 words. Mm. They want big, thick books because they want sort of shelf space in bookshop. The whole thing about publishing really bonkers.
Yeah, it's crazy. And I mean, of all the affirmation, it's so tightly put together. Picking out one word in five seems bonkers. Yeah,
why don't you pick them out? you say to the publisher, you have to do it. Take them out. Get rid of them. But
I've got one question actually. It's maybe specific, but maybe it goes on to something more general. Because I just recently read The Glamour, and I went to the see when it was published initially, which is 1984. I think it was in the copy. It said, but something as I was reading it, there's a reference to Sue having an Apple Mac in her. Were Apple Macs around then? So I did a bit of Googling and stuff. And then in the process, it's on a blog or somewhere, I think that there was a revised version of the Glamour came out, which is maybe the version that I have. I was intrigued at the process because I think it was in 1995 a revised version was published.
The thing was, there's a scene in the Glamour. As I remember, she has this dysfunctional boyfriend who's kind of stalking her, and he phones her from somewhere, and he can apparently see her, and she doesn't know where he is. And I thought, all that scene completely collapses if a mobile phone's used, because that's what people do with mobile phones. It doesn't matter where they are. You can make it from a plane or a train or something like that. And so I thought this really dated it. So I was always unhappy with that scene because it was quite an important one. And then BBC dramatized the Glamour. They did it as a play for Today or something on Radio 4. And I did the dramatization. And so I worked around that for the dramatization. It went out, and that was that. And then the publisher said, we're going to reissue the Glamour. So I said, hey, I've had some second thoughts. And so I went through the original manuscript. I didn't change it much, but I took the opportunity to introduce mobile phones because I knew they weren't going to go away. You don't want people spending your phone boxes. Nobody ever knew. A couple of scenes which I thought worked in the play, I put into the novel. So it's still essentially the same novel. It's not changed, but I felt it just tightened up a bit.
I guess that had been sort of niggling at you as you remember the scene and wanted to change it. I mean, is that something that I would apply to other novels as well, that you sort of going over the plot of, that was published 30 years ago, but still that I'd like to tweak this scene? Or
in The Separation, which is, as I say, a wartime book, guy gets in his Lancaster and flies, takes off his Lancaster and flies over Lincoln, crosses Lincoln Cathedral, and has a look at the spire as he goes by. I have about 20 letters from people who say, there's no spire on Lincoln Cathedral. So when the paperback came out, I made sure that was checked.
I think you could have brazened that out, because so many people wrote to you about it. Your response could be like, what, do you think I would have put that in there?
You mean you never saw it?
I mean, I think you're in a very privileged position to be able to play with these sort of factual or non-factual elements pop up in your writing, or the writing of yours I've read in such a clever way. I don't think there's, as a reader, you're always half doubting, is there a spire on that cathedral? No, I live next to it, but now I'm not too sure.
Well, the Persian rug makers, they always weave into the design a floor. Do you know about that?
No.
Persian rugs are beautiful things, very ornate designs, but there's always a mistake in them. And the weaver puts it in to show that he's mortal, that he's not God. So it's that kind of deliberate mistake. Quite interesting.
I just wonder if there's any non-deliberate mistakes that make their way in as well. I mean,
I'm intrigued at how you classify a mistake in a, I mean, obviously, if there's a hole in the middle of the rug, that's a clear mistake. But I presume it's more in the design.
Well, I've got the novel that came out this year, Airside. There are a few found texts in it. And one of them is a film review from Time Out, which I credited to Time Out. somebody wrote to me and said, Time Out wasn't publishing film reviews then. So that niggles. Yeah. And I haven't checked it out.
How much would it... I mean, would it only be if there's a reissue or the publisher gets in touch to say, you know, we're doing a new print, would you then say, oh, I want to change this? Or do you have a sort of, when something comes along, do you send an email to the publisher and say, oh, I've just noticed this, can you...
Or I would never get them to do it. You can never, ever get a publisher to sort of change your text. They'll cock it up.
Especially if it's taking one word in five out of a manuscript.
No, the thing is, I think in that particular case, I'd just let it go. It doesn't matter. And it's the state of health I'm in at the moment, and time is precious. I don't really want to fizzle around with something. Oh, I don't want to get on with what I'm doing.
What are you currently working on at the moment, if you don't mind me asking? No. Is it your biography of J.G. Ballard? Or
I'm writing a biography of J.G. Ballard.
And what stage are you up to? Obviously, that requires quite a lot of research. I mean, are you... Yeah.
I'm working with a kind of scholar, a researcher, who has spent his life studying J.G. Ballard. But he didn't want to write. When I came across his work, I wrote to him and said, look, you should do this as a biography. It's really hot stuff. And he's an old friend of mine. And he said, oh, I can't be bothered. I don't do that. It's too much work. So I said, well, let me do it. So on the nod, we suddenly decided I'd write the book and use his research as the background. It's not, I'm not just using his research, but it's, I can get the actual facts, very useful source of going through them. But at the moment, I'm busy reading Ballard all the way through, and I'm interviewing, you know, witnesses who are still alive and doing a full-scale job. So I wrote a lot of it in hospital. And so I was stuck in this cancer hospital 6 weeks, and fortunately I had the computer with me, and I could get about 2 or 3 hours when they weren't sticking things in me, and I could sort of work. So I did, and I wrote quite a lot of it in the hospital, and I came out about 2 months ago, and I've been doing much more since. I'm trying to get it finished before I get to the fall over.
Is it fairly sort of straightforward biography, or are you kind of drawn to add any sort of novelistic elements in, or
it's both? It's fully authentic, complete research, it's complete cross reference, and all the facts are checked and double checked. Ballard was very loquacious. He did lots of interviews, and most of them were available in print or online. And he wrote some brilliant essays. A book has just come out this week. J.G. Ballard, Selected Nonfiction, 1962 to 2007, came out this week, and is a really excellent book. I mean, it's just bits and pieces, things he wrote for The Guardian and letters he wrote to some people, but they're very well chosen. The things he came up with, really fascinating. I mean, 50 years ago, he exactly predicted social media.
I've not read that book, but yeah, he was very prescient, I think, in a lot of things, and while not being too like the vision of the future rather than specifics. Although social media is.
He actually says everyone will have a TV studio in their home, and everyone will be in contact constantly by television with each other. I mean, the mobile phones didn't exist when he said this. And it's really, he was a real visionary. And he tossed his ideas off all the time. He was very good on cinema. He saw the way that cinema was going. He was a great film fan. And he could see this sort of a degeneration into cheap genres, like, you know, the Marvel Universe and all this shit that comes out all the time. He saw this coming, and that this would be the death of, or not the death, but a serious threat to cinema, to the people who made serious films. And it's now the case you just can't get money to make a film unless you do some sort of alternative deal that the studios just don't want it. They want people in tights and superhero shit and...
There's no mid-budget, is there? It's either incredibly cheaply made sort of artful stuff, or that the thing where you'll start watching the film and it's got production companies and state-funded production companies from all around Europe. It'll have about 25 of them at the start of the film. Or it's, every screen. I live near Westfield, the massive shopping centre, and every single screen will be showing whatever's the latest Marvel or whatever film. I just don't understand how there's enough people going through the door to...
And the first thing you see in every film now is an identity, a something film from such and such studio, made by, with the cooperation of Ulster government. And then you just get these sort of seven or eight sort of contributors. And then, a film by, and finally you get to it. Yeah. And then you've seen that these people have all had stuck a finger in the pie. It must be absolute hell. And this is the answer to this mystery shopping, which is you get by a book by a writer, the writer's written it.
Yeah, there might be a Dominic Cummings editor if you're unlucky in between, but saving that, yeah. It's a very direct connection.
Well, thank you to Christopher, obviously, and to his loved ones, if they have been listening to this. It was great speaking to him. Thank you to you for listening. We will put some links up to Christopher's work and the website that he maintains. And seek out his books. He just has some incredibly interesting ideas. Mm. That he managed to turn into words.
Yeah. His website is still up there, and I guess it's not being updated, but he has a lot of thoughts and links and stuff on there to check out his works. And of course, you can check out other conversations from our back catalogue either at unsoundmethods.co.uk or find us on Twitter at unsoundmethods. I think we've got over 60 now, is it?
I think this will be episode 63. So, yeah, there are 62 others to go back and discover. And you can find out about us and our writing in the episode notes below on jamiebatchin.com, at Jamie Batchin on X, Twitter, and at Jamie_Batchin on Instagram.
Yeah, and you can find me at lachlanbloom.com or through there find various other things.
Thanks again for listening, and raise a glass to Christopher Priest.